Welcome back to the Steely Dan Tour radio special on the Album Network. I'm Walter Becker of Steely Dan with Redbeard.
I'm Donald Fagen of Steely Dan with Redbeard.
Well, I think the main reason that Countdown was different had to do with the fact that the band was together and playing live and playing together more. And so the way that we dealt with our tunes in terms of arranging the tunes was more influenced by the contributions of the various members of the band and also to the type of structure that would be useful in, for playing live rather than so much compact hit song, hit record type of, you know, verse chorus deals. That was one reason. I think another reason is that there's a general syndrome that happens with second albums. You know, people who write their own material, you have, you know, your whole life up until the time that you make your first album to get songs for that one, and then you have a few months to get together the songs for the next one. And yeah, that was true. And some of those songs on the second one existed before, you know, had been written before we even did the first one, but a bunch of them were new songs. You always want to do your new songs. So, you know, I think that that was a factor as well. I remember that we were out on the road. We'd be touring on the weekend and then come back and work in the studio during the week. So that made things very different. And, you know, and also we had been successful with the first album, so we felt more or less empowered to stretch out in whatever direction we might occur to us. So some of the things that we did were more experimental or in terms of, you know, the way they were put together and so on. For example, Showbiz Kids was, you know, was a tape loop that we did and was built that way, and that was something new for us and things like that. So I think, you know, we felt good about trying different things, and I remember at the time when we finished the album, the people at the record company were kind of, they didn't quite know what to do about it either. You know, they were a little confused, and I'm not sure what it was that they had been expecting, but this wasn't it, and so there was a little disappointment there that it didn't do as well. Although I think it did well enough, it didn't have any hit singles on it. You know, the song that we chose to be the hit single was Showbiz Kid, to be the single was Showbiz Kids, and that had a dirty word in it, and that probably wouldn't even be appropriate for this interview. So we had to edit that out, and, you know, so we were kind of, and they made us pick the single. That was kind of an odd thing, so we made not a very good choice. So it was a little bit of a disappointment in terms of the sales and so on. But I thought it was a very interesting album. And as a matter of fact, over the years, a lot of people have told me, quite a number of people have told me that that was their favorite album. And I think the reason that, yeah, see, the engineer has given me the high sign in there. I think that part of the reason for that is it captured the more of the feeling of a real band, a live band excitement. And it was interesting structures, you know?
Time. I have never 'cause he looks so fine up on that hill. They tell me he was lonely, he's lonely still. Those days are gone forever, over a long time ago. The man gave me the news. He said, "You must be joking, son. Where did you get those shoes? Where did you get those shoes?" Well, I've seen them on the TV, the movie show. They say the times are changing, but I just don't know. These things are gone.
You know, and now that I think about it, I have to say that in some ways we were disappointed with it too, or at least to the extent that when we went in to do the third album, we did it a completely different way. So Pretzelogic had, rather than recording with the band, which we had been doing up until then with the occasional hired hand, when we went in to cut tracks with Pretzelogic, the band was primarily studio players. With the occasional addition of me or Donald, to for the initial tracking, and then Baxter and Denny and Jimmy Hodder added overdubs to those tracks. But so for most of the songs, the drummer was a guy named Jim Gordon, and Jeff Beccaro was on one or two tunes. Most of the piano playing was, Michael Omardian, and Dean Parks played guitar on some things, and I still played bass on some things, but Chuck Rainey played on a couple things as well. So it was a different approach for us, and one where we thought that we could tailor the actual band and band members to the particular songs that, you know, the needs of a particular song, and that's something that we kind of ended up doing more and more as the years went on.
We hear you're leaving, that's okay. I thought our little wild time had just begun. I guess you kind of scared yourself. If you have a change of heart, Ricky, don't
There was a little problem. We had been touring in the States for quite a while, and by the time we got over there, I think we did 4 or 5 of the shows, and Donald was having a problem. He had some sort of infection, sore throat problem, and he couldn't sing anymore. So we went back home, and that was the end of the tour. Well, it was a little disappointing, but on the other hand, I think the band was really good for the 5 shows that we did, and you know, by all accounts, created a lasting impression. And I stayed on for the rest of the tour anyway, even after the band went home, just to hang out, and I had a good time. So it was disappointing, but afterwards we did some touring in the States a month after we got back, or something like that. We had a little tour in California. We did a bunch of gigs. Yeah.
Everywhere if it's right. But until my ship comes in, I live night by night. When the Joker tried to tell me I could cut it in this rural town, when he tried to hang that sign on me, I said, take it down.
Now, when did you realize that Steely Dan had acquired a certain mystery that really has maintained to this day? When did you realize it?
I just realized that now.
Oh,
as you
come
said.
On.
Well, you know, if you read, you know, the music media, you know, there started to be this sort of thing about, you know, this mystique. I really think it really had to do with the fact that we stopped touring and no one would ever see us, and yet we'd continue to put out records that sold well. So, you know, that was about it, really.
Also, your countenance never appeared on any Steely Dan album covers, on the fronts anyway, and
there's a good reason for that.
And why is that, guys?
I can't remember. Somebody we knew or said, some critic once early on when we first started playing said, you know, it's with the ugliest band they'd ever seen.
How do you think Steely Dan would fare breaking into the business in this video era?
No chance.
Not a chance in hell.
Nah.
Nah, we'd have to work in a bookstore.
We'd be bloop out of luck.
Now, you're both bright boys, so one of the few criticisms by the late
Not
70s.
Not according to my biology teacher, Mr. Beemuller, in high school.
Did he flunk you?
Almost. A lot of tap dancing now, yeah.
Yeah. One of the few criticisms that ever, I think, stuck was... that you were maybe too clever, too lyrically coy. This was in the late 70s. But, you know, in my lengthy conversations, particularly with Walter, I've always heard really sincere humility. What devices do you employ to kind of keep each other grounded?
Sincere humility is the one I use the most.
In what way are you using the word grounded?
Electrically.
Well, there's lightning rods on the ends of her glasses.
Donald has a alligator clip, which goes from his...
You know what it is? It's those three prongs. You got to have a third prong.
That's the third prong, yeah. Exactly.
Guess what my next question was? How about humor? Your collective sense...
No place for it.
No place for it. You're too serious, right?
We have a serious message to deliver, and we can't jeopardize our ability to deliver that with some silly jokes.
I really think that's one of the things that I've enjoyed most about Steely Dan music, and also about interviewing you guys, is the kind of a collective sense of, I think they called it in the booklet, urban humor.
I think we watched too many of those Steve Allen shows, you know, those early ones.
I never seen you looking so bad, my funky one. You tell me that your super fine mind has come undone. Any major dude with half a heart surely will tell you, my friend. Any minor world that breaks apart falls together again. When the demon is at your door, in the morning it won't be there no more. Any major dude will tell you. Any major dude will tell you. Seen a squawk's tears? Well, look at mine. The people on the street have all seen better times. Any major dude with half a heart surely will tell you, my friend. Any minor world that breaks apart falls together again. When the demon is at your door, in the morning it won't be there no more.
Well, the band at that time consisted of myself, Donald, Jeff Baxter, Denny Dias, and Jimmy Hotter, the original guys from the band. Plus, we had a second drummer, and that was Jeff Beccaro. We had a second keyboard player, and that was Mike McDonald, and he also did a bunch of singing. You know, he sang in all the harmonies, and I think he sang a chorus or two of a couple of the songs. He did Showbiz Kids, I think, and he did a chorus in Pretzel Logic, the song Pretzel Logic. And then there was a vocalist / percussionist named Royce Jones from Los Angeles, and that was the band. Yeah, sure. It was at Santa Monica Civic Auditorium, and I think it was July 5th. or thereabouts, 74, that would have been, right? Right around the 4th of July. Remember one of the guys who was working with the band got married backstage before the show, and it was a good, he was an Englishman, he needed a green card. And I don't know if Keith is out there listening, but how you doing, Keith? And so, that was the last show.
Welcome back to the Steely Dan Tour radio special on the Album Network. I'm Walter Becker of Steely Dan with Redbeard.
I'm Donald Fagen of Steely Dan with Redbeard.
You know, when we talked individually in the summer of 1990, each one of you individually downplayed the cessation of touring in 74 and the lack thereof until recently. But in the box set, the Citizen Steely Dan essays in the booklet, really, you kind of self-consciously allow much to be made of the return to live performance. Is this conveniently self-serving, or have you really had a change of heart regarding making your music in front of Steely Dan fans?
Again, I think both.
Both change of heart. Yeah. And you know what's really changed more than anything else is the situation we're in, which back when we were touring in the early 70s, it was a very, the quality of the performances was extremely uneven and unpredictable from night to night. We were barely making enough money to go out and actually do it with at all, you know.
Technically, the sound was, you know.
Yeah, it was a drag. You know, there were a lot of things going on that made it not very much fun to do, and you couldn't really be confident that you were going to put on good shows, you know, and acquit yourself well.
We had to open for Sha Na Na.
Wow.
We did open for Sha Na Na.
Wow.
That was a weird triple bill. It was Chuck Berry, Sha Na Na, and Steely Dan.
Actually, I liked that one.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Well, it was, but I mean, you have to wonder who put that one together. Whether there was some mistake, you know, whether they'd gotten us mistaken. Us for some other band,
or maybe
opening for Slade was really
Slade.
That was an honor.
Mm. So what were your concerns initially when you decided to make the big leap almost 19, 20 years later? What were your initial concerns about taking it out?
I think one of the concerns was we didn't want to be seen as a nostalgia band, and so we got the kind of players we knew would add something to the tunes. We tried to change the arrangements a bit of some of the old tunes so we'd have some fun playing them. And of course, I think one thing was automatic in keeping it away from the nostalgia thing is that we, because we hadn't been on the road in so many years, most of the tunes we were doing had never been played live, so we were essentially approaching a new bunch of tunes that we'd never really worked with before. And I think that that was really part of it.
There was a bit of a conflict in the band. Some of the band members who were interested in the band playing and touring as much as possible, because they enjoyed it a lot, and they felt that that's what the band should be doing. Whereas Donald and myself and Denny, perhaps to a lesser extent, felt that the live shows were never quite as good as we wanted them to be, and it wasn't any fun for us. It was just a big pain, basically. So the way we resolved that dispute is that the guys who wanted to tour all the time ended up leaving the band and, going on to do other things. And at that point, we didn't have a band anymore. We didn't really have a band to tour with. And so that was a convenient excuse for Donald and myself to tell the record company that we didn't want to tour anymore because we couldn't. So at that point, and we felt that we didn't really need to tour. We thought if we made really good records, people would buy them, even if we didn't appear in their town, for the simple reason that, as you know, it's an extremely effective promotional device. But granting that, it just isn't appropriate for everybody. Some people are not good performers on stage or are, for one reason or another, not able to reproduce what they do on their records on stage, or they just don't want to do it. And I think now it's much easier for people to say, well, we can't do that, and we'll do something else in exchange, you know, because of the fact that now you have MTV, it seems to me that it's perfectly possible for a band, you know, for people to feel like they've seen a band perform, even though that band may never have performed. Well, no, I think it's quite true that when you're playing, touring like that, the time that you're actually on stage is unquestionably the best time of the day, and it's the kind of raison d'etre for that whole, you know, for everything else that goes on. And that was as true for us as it was for everybody else. But at the same time, it was just another way of creating something. And, you know, we kind of got spoiled by being studio guys, you know, and working in studios and relating to records perhaps more than we related to live performance. And with the control and level, you know, when you're making a record, the way we did it, we were kind of the auteurs of the record, in the sense that a director is the, you know, the author of his film. That's right. It's the control room. So, you know, and no matter what happens, you don't have that on stage. And so maybe it was a little less rewarding than making a record. And also a record is something that lasts, you know. And performance doesn't. So I think that as much fun as it is to perform live, and also, and here's another thing, when you're out on a stage performing, you're kind of, regardless of what kind of music you're playing, in the type of arenas that we were playing in, you're in show business. I don't think that it was ever Donald's or my intention to be in show business. We wanted to be musicians and to make music. And so performing in front of audiences in that particular way that you do when you're playing in front of 5 or 10,000 people took us a little away from that, and was not quite what we had in mind. Now, what I noticed was that other people who were more performers as well as musicians than, say, we were, because we just kind of stood there and played, you know. People who were more adapted to that enjoyed it more, and that's why it was a significant enough payoff to make all the other stuff worthwhile for them. Also, they liked, you know, all of the bad food and the diseases and everything. I mean, they complain about it now, but the fact of the matter is that I saw the looks on their faces when they were enjoying that stuff. Show.
platform. The man gave me the news. He said, "You must be joking. Well, did you get those shoes?
Dan 50th anniversary is dedicated to the brilliant, superbly talented, and irreverently funny Walter Becker, who died of complications with esophageal cancer in September 2017. God bless you, Walter. We miss you dearly. In the Studio is produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Redbeard Rocks Productions. Copyright 2023, all rights reserved. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Listen to all of your favorite rock interviews on In the Studio with Redbeard on Facebook, on Spotify, and online at inthestudio.net.